Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection, originating from Alaska Public Media here in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your co-host, Dr. Thad Woodard. In our August 21st program, we discussed the prevention of the effects of fetal alcohol exposure. Today, we're going to be discussing developmental disabilities and birth defects that are attributed to fetal alcohol exposure and some effective interventions. Our guests are Marilyn Pierce Bulger. She is an advanced nurse practitioner and owner of FASDX Services, which is the referral and coordination agency for the Anchorage Fetal Alcohol Spectrum Disorders Diagnostic Team. Also joining us by telephone is Dr. Susan Astley. She's professor of epidemiology and pediatrics with the University of Washington School of Public Health and Medicine, and director of the Washington State Fetal Alcohol Syndrome Diagnostic and Prevention Network. And also joining Marilyn in the studio is Christy Reinhart. Christy is the program coordinator, is a program coordinator, with the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education. And she's been working on a five-year strategic plan for FASD, that's fetal alcohol spectrum disorders, in Alaska. Over the course of the next 58 minutes or so, if you have questions or comments or would like to just give us some information of that you think is important about fetal alcohol exposure and treatments, there is a couple of ways you can get a hold of us. Our local number is 550-8433, 550-8433. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org, and if you want to spell that out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, line1@alaskapublic.org. We also have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Having done all that, Marilyn and Christy, I want to say thanks for coming, and Dr. Astley, thanks for joining us as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, so let's start with some definitions. I've used a couple of terms. I've said fetal alcohol syndrome, and I've also talked about fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. Can somebody among you three help me understand what we're talking about today?
He's looking at me. So this is Marilyn. I'll answer that question. So fetal alcohol spectrum disorders is a range of disabilities that are the result of prenatal alcohol exposure, with the most impact generally being thought of as fetal alcohol syndrome, which was first identified at the University of Washington in 1973, so relatively recent history. And it can also encompass something called partial fetal alcohol syndrome, static encephalopathy, neurobehavioral disorder, and there is some Institute of Medicine terminology that you'll see in the literature as well that include alcohol-related birth defects, which are the physical manifestations, or alcohol-related neurodevelopmental disorder, which are the behavioral manifestations.
All right. So if I heard you correctly, the right way to think about this is when we say fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, that's not a diagnosis. It's an encompassing term, which includes the diagnoses of that are problems that associated with fetal alcohol exposure.
That represent a range of disability or manifestation of this basically brain injury that began in the prenatal environment.
Susan, were you saying this correctly?
That sounds good to me.
Okay.
Again, FASD is typically considered an umbrella term under which there are, as Marilyn pointed out, four or five different diagnoses under the umbrella of FASD.
All right. So how common is this disorder? And I'm gonna preface that already by saying it can be difficult at times to make the diagnosis. So when we start talking about these, how common these are, we have to keep that in mind. So, Dr. Astley, can I ask you that question?
Sure. You know, when we talk about the umbrella term FASD, and again, these are very general kind of estimates because we're still struggling to get accurate estimates, but in general, when you look at the entire umbrella of FASD, its prevalence is about 2-5% of the population. And one way to kind of put that into context is considering that autism occurs in about 1% of the population. Again, FASD occurs in about 2-5% of the population. So it's more prevalent than autism. And then as we talked about just a minute ago, FASD is an umbrella term. If you look at the prevalence of just FAS, the most severe diagnosis under the umbrella, generally there's about one out of every 1,000 individuals has FAS in the general population. And as the risk in that group increases, let's say from the general population to foster care, the prevalence of FAS goes up tenfold. So in foster care, it's about 1 in 100 compared to 1 in 1,000 in the general population. So those are our best estimates today, but stay posted with increased diagnosis and accuracy of diagnosis. We're improving those estimates.
Given the already proviso that it's hard to be really concrete sometimes about diagnosis, can we say with any assurance whether the incidence of fetal alcohol syndrome the spectrum disorders are increasing or decreasing over time?
This is Susan. Can I take a crack at that one?
Yep, I was addressing that.
I'm proud to announce that in Washington State, we have actual empirical evidence that the prevalence of full-blown FAS is, in fact, going down and has been for the past 20, 30 years. And the reason I can say that is, you know, we've actually been tracking that over time. And the reason we can say that pretty accurately, too, is, as Marilyn mentioned, FAS was first discovered at the University of Washington back in 1973. So because of that, we've had a huge head start on all other states or countries around the world, for that matter, in trying to prevent this. So, but when we look at our records, we can actually document a significant decline in the prevalence of children being born with FAS with each successive birth cohort. And for folks that are interested in seeing that graphically on our FASDPN website, I've got a Tableau dashboard, an interactive dashboard, where you can actually see that data and see it going down significantly. I have little doubt that the same thing is occurring in Alaska, because folks in Alaska have been working on this as long as the folks here in Washington State. It's just that we've had a bit of an advantage of having the necessary data to be able to track it over time and begin to look at that.
So, let me ask this. Can you attribute some particular reasons? Is it public education? Is it a change in alcohol consumption? Is it a change in birth control? What would you attribute that to in Washington?
In Washington, we actually did a study to answer that very question. In other words, there's kind of two ways to prevent FASD. One, don't drink while pregnant, or two, don't get pregnant while drinking.
Right.
So either family planning or alcohol treatment. And in a study we did way back in the 90s in Washington State, we found that actually prevention is actually more successful in Washington State based on a decrease in women drinking during pregnancy, more so than it was with increased birth control. And this was back in the 90s, so that was a whole different era of availability of birth control. It could be different now. But more than anything, I'd have to say it's public health education. I've been in this field since 1981, and I still remember like it was yesterday when I'd give a talk about FASD to a group of medical students and ask for them to raise their hands, who's ever heard of FAS? And back in that day, back in the 80s, it was the rare individual that had even heard of it, much less knew that we should be not, that somebody shouldn't be drinking during pregnancy. So just a huge impact on public education and the invention of the internet.
I want to chime in here just from the perspective of Alaska, but also some work I'm doing. This is Marilyn. Mm-hmm. Some work I'm doing with Centers for Disease Control nationally. And one of the things we're seeing is a rise in higher dose pattern of drinking, where women are drinking more than 3 drinks on an occasion, which is what we know is more impactful to a developing embryo or fetus. Mm-hmm. And these women are not women who have an addiction necessarily. These are women who are either not realizing they're early pregnant or maybe choosing to continue to use alcohol during pregnancy. And unfortunately, we do have a group of women who are doing that, believing that there's not much risk if they use alcohol in a lower dose way. Mm-hmm. So we've got some work to do still. Per CDC, about 3 million women per month are at risk for an alcohol-exposed pregnancy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. I just seems to me, I just saw something from the CDC that in general, adolescent girls and boys are drinking a little less and maybe having a little less sex. That sounds good. But what you're saying is there is still a significant group of girls that are drinking quite heavily and probably not being as careful about
and
birth
not
control
just girls. The data is telling us that the women who are continuing to use alcohol in pregnancy are 30 in their 30s, white, working, college-educated women. Mm-hmm. So this is shifting in terms of who our risk populations are. And I think one of the things we have to think about from a public health perspective is, how do you message these different groups around alcohol use and pregnancy? Right. Because they need different information.
Right. And as you all have implied, autism is getting a huge amount of publicity, but fetal alcohol, which is, you know, at least as common, maybe twice to, or quite a bit more common if we look at the whole spectrum disorders, may not be appreciated as well. Which leads to even more difficulty in kind of getting the message out.
And FASD is also a developmental disability in that, you know, it's not unlike autism and that some of the symptoms are very similar and may overlap. And it often is not identifiable in the under age 6 crowd. Dr. Astley can talk more about that because they've been looking at that for a lot of years. But for the individuals who don't have the physical manifestations, which are most of the folks who've had prenatal exposure, roughly, I think it's 9% may meet criteria for FAS. These folks are hard to identify.
Before we talk about the specifics, well, let me do one thing. Let me go ahead and give our phone number again, and then I want to talk about what groups of people may be, if any, at higher risk, who, and continue this epidemiology of business a little bit. Let me remind the listeners again, you're listening to Line One, your health connection today. We're talking about the diagnosis and interventions available for the fetal alcohol spectrum disorder group of diagnoses. If you have questions or comments, our local number, 550-8433, 550-8433. Email address is line1@alaskapublic.org, and our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. So what do we know about whether certain races, socioeconomic groups, different peoples have related to the prevalence of fetal alcohol syndrome?
Susan, you probably have the better data. I'm going to defer to you. This is Marilyn.
Yeah, this is Susan. I, you know, when it comes to alcohol and its teratogenic impact, I like to refer to it as an equal opportunity teratogen. You know, in broad terms, essentially anybody exposed to alcohol is at risk, and it's less dependent on your socioeconomic status, your race, your gender, than it is just simply the quantity and frequency of alcohol you're being exposed to. That's one way to address the question. Another way is, you know, in terms of what subgroups in the population are at highest risk, it's the same subgroups that are at highest risk for alcohol abuse and exposure. In other words, as goes alcohol abuse, goes FASD, and for all the same reasons. You could ask the same question, who's at highest risk for alcoholism and why? And again, socioeconomic status is a huge indicator of that.
All right. So now let's kind of ferret out, if we can, the effects on the fetus. And any of you all can tackle this. I'm sure there may be other comments along the way, because there's a large group of effects here. Marilyn, you want to start with some of this, and then we'll ask Dr. Astley to comment as well.
So the classic physical manifestations that you see and that you need for the full FAS diagnosis are the triad of facial features that are distinctive related to alcohol exposure, which is the small eye opening that then makes the mid-face between the eyes appear wider, the very flat or near absent vertical groove between the underside of the nose and the upper lip, and then a fairly thin or absent upper lip, or it's called the vermilion border of the lip. In addition to those facial features, children with full FAS have growth deficiencies that are generally below the 10th percentile. And some children have facial features without the growth or vice versa, and those kids may fall into the partial FAS diagnosis category. There are many other, because alcohol is a teratogen, which I think is underappreciated, particularly by the population that is choosing to continue to drink in pregnancy. A teratogen is a substance or an entity that can actually kill and alter the cells, the developing cells in the embryo or the fetus. It's both a structural and functional teratogen, and it can have an impact on virtually any part of the fetal architecture, if you want to think of it that way. Most of that impact is going to happen in the first trimester, but there's no trimester that is safe in terms of alcohol use. And the brain is the main target the entire 9 months. So this neural pathway development is really, really very sensitive to the impact of the teratogen.
Dr. Astley, any comments about the classic findings that Marilyn has commented on, and then perhaps you might expand more on some of the neurobehavioral consequences, which are rather protean.
Yeah, I think probably a lot of the listeners realize at this point in time that, you know, the description that Marilyn just gave is in when somebody presents with all of those features, that's what we call full FAS, and that does tend to be one of the rare outcomes. The vast majority of individuals exposed to alcohol and damaged by it don't have full FAS. And the primary reason we believe that to be true is that, by definition, to have a diagnosis of FAS, you have to have the facial features. And in terms of timing of exposure, what's interesting is that we believe, based on research to date, that the window of time during pregnancy, during a 9-month period of pregnancy, that a woman would have to drink to create those specific facial features in the fetus is a very narrow window of time, maybe just weeks 3 and 4 in pregnancy, period. So even the alcoholic could potentially miss that very narrow window of time, give birth to a child who has, you know, significant brain dysfunction, but none of the facial features. So the timing of the exposure is pretty important when it comes to the different outcomes. Marilyn also mentioned kind of there's the physical outcomes, the facial features, the growth deficiency, the small head circumference microcephaly. Those are kind of physical features that we see in FAS. And then there's the brain damage, the dysfunction. And it's clearly the dysfunction that has the biggest impact on the individual with the FASD and their caregivers. And I'd say one thing that's been interesting to learn over time is that with FASD, if there's anything that typifies FASD, it's kids exposed to alcohol and damaged by it tend to look deceptively good between birth and 6 years of age. In other words, it's not uncommon at all for us to see young children coming into clinic with big-time exposures, but surprisingly normal development. Like, how could that even happen? You've been exposed to so much alcohol. And typically, it's not real. In other words, at the moment, they look like they're developing normally, but wait till they get to be 8, 9 years of age, when higher-level thinking skills are supposed to start kicking in. That's when you really start to see the full impact of the alcohol. So I think if there's anything, you know, one of the strong messages for clinicians even out there is that if you're working with young children, birth to 3, birth to 6, who have been exposed to alcohol, and at the moment they look like they're developmentally normal, don't make the mistake of deciding that they were somehow spared the impacts of alcohol. We can always hope that's true, but really important to track them very closely after the age of 6 to make sure that they continue to develop normally, because many of them won't. And most recent research that we've seen also indicates that when these young kids present with any or especially all of those physical markers, that's the subset of young kids that are exposed that are going to be most likely to present with the more severe brain damage as they get older.
So as a clinician, what I'm the corollary was is that we all should be asking carefully when we start seeing infants about the possibility of alcohol exposure, just to perhaps alert ourselves to continue to watch that child more carefully over time.
Yes, this is Marilyn. One of the things that I'm observing that's interesting is I'm seeing discordant. Now, Dr. Astley talked about microcephaly, which is a head size that's significantly, you know, small. But I'm seeing discordant head circumference percentiles in relation to the child's height and weight. Mother Nature generally doesn't want that to happen in the prenatal environment. Mother Nature will try to save brain at the cost of a baby's body. So if I see a child who has maybe a 15th percentile head circumference and a 50th for height or weight or whatever, that's quite a big difference. And as a pediatric provider, I would want to be looking at that over time. I've also seen some of the kids who develop what we would identify as a microcephaly later than the typical time when we are measuring heads. You know, typically in pediatrics, we're stopping that process around age two. So for a child who's had prenatal exposure, I think we clinically need to be looking at some things we should be doing differently for screening them long term.
Yeah, that's an interesting observation. And as a pediatrician, you're right. If I'm looking at a baby who was just born, I look at their percentiles of height, weight, and head circumference. And I'm thinking in my own mind, nutritional versus genetic. I don't spend enough time thinking about toxic effects. And so what I'm looking for is weight's affected first, then height, then head circumference. As you said, we normally protect it. So what I'm hearing you say is be alert for the kid with a small head circumference relative to the other things.
I think it might be
not just genetics. It could be this
alcohol.
Teratogenic genetic effect. Yeah,
exactly.
And pick that
I've
up.
Also seen some kids who's, like Dr. Astley's done some nice work looking at how the growth score using the UW four-digit code. If it's a more impacted growth, they definitely have more impacted brain-based differences. Mm-hmm. But I'm seeing kids who may have a growth score that's not particularly low at birth, but then over time it starts to drop off. And it may never reach that below the 10th percentile point, but it may drop many percentage points. And I think, again, we wonder whether or not that may also be something going on. And I'd be interested in Susan's thoughts about that.
Yeah, that, Marilyn's talking about the growth study that we just finished, and you know, I've been doing this for 30 years, and I was just stunned at what we found when we actually did an empirical analysis looking at all the growth measures. But we all know, or most of us know, that cigarette smoking during pregnancy is kind of a number one cause of low birth weight in infants. And we also know that alcohol can also result in low birth weight. And so oftentimes it's been hard to tease those apart. The child who's been exposed to cigarettes and alcohol, born with low birth weight, well, what did it? The tobacco, the alcohol, both, you know. And so our study documented that the low birth weight that, or, and length that we're seeing is far better explained by the cigarette smoking, and that the type of growth deficiency that we can very strongly associate with the alcohol is postnatal short stature. Okay, and that's what Marilyn was trying to share, that they can be born at a normal, you know, in a normal size, but then start to fall below their birth length measure in short stature as they get older, and not necessarily below the 10th centile, but just simply decelerate in their normal growth in height. And so that was fascinating to see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as a pediatrician, I don't want to get on this too much. There are a group of kids that height, weight, and head circumference, everything decelerates for a while between 6 months and a year. We'll see that commonly, but anyway, that's just a comment to maybe discuss how complex this can be at times.
It is. Yeah.
We have a phone call. Matt, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
So at the beginning of the program, I thought it sounded like you were making a sort of a relationship between autism and fetal alcohol spectrum or syndrome, just the relationship of how prevalent it is. And I'm just curious if are some children who are diagnosed autistic, could it actually be fetal alcohol spectrum disorder? And
Yes.
As well or instead of? I mean, there's two questions there. Right. That's a great question.
And in addition to.
Yeah.
That's Christy. Co-occurrence. Yeah. This is Christy.
Yep.
Yeah. So the diagnostic team here in Anchorage has actually seen children who we really felt did have autism, but they also had FASD. You know, and we also probably have seen a spike in children who have autism diagnoses when, in fact, what they really have is an FASD. And part of that, the reason we're not thinking about that, I think, is because of stigma around alcohol use in pregnancy and stigma around the diagnosis of FASD. But also, we often don't have the alcohol history. And certainly the pediatric community frequently is having a harder time getting it. As a women's health professional, I am on a mission to really try to change that upstream with regard to helping the OB community change
really,
that.
Because really, you know, I mean, of the two, fetal alcohol syndrome is the only one that we know is completely avoidable.
You're
you
right.
You know, as in autism, we don't really know what causes it.
You're right. You're right. You're right, Matt. One of the other things I'll just make a comment on, because there's been some discussion in the world of FASD recently around some messaging that we used to use around 100% preventable. And one of the things about that is that I think that sets things up for blame and shame, which we really don't want to be doing. And I, as a women's health professional, have seen many, many women over the years of my clinical career who stopped as soon as they realized they were pregnant, or they had a birth control failure or something else that happened, and they were simply living their life. So I think it's preventable.
As a layperson, I would say, I mean, I know I'm familiar with FASD, but until this show today, I had no idea that just the first couple of weeks could be impacted by alcohol.
Right.
I just assumed it later on, whenever things, organs and things are starting to develop. But
yeah. Yeah, Matt, keep in mind that when things are first starting to form, that may be one of the most sensitive times for birth defects in particular, okay?
Right.
Structural problems and so forth. Yeah.
Thank you for your call.
Often before anybody knows you're pregnant.
For bringing this to the front.
You bet.
Yeah.
You bet. I want to come back and talk a little bit about the mechanism where alcohol may cause an effect, but particularly get into this issue of how much alcohol should be considered safe. I'm choosing my words carefully, as you will find out. But we'll do that when we come back. I want to take our break. I want to remind everybody once again, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. Our local number is 550-8433. Toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. Email address line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a one-minute break, and we'll continue the discussion on the diagnosis and interventions for fetal alcohol spectrum disorders with Marilyn Pierce-Bolger, Christy Reinhart, and Dr. Susan Ashley. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard, and today we're discussing how we might identify and intervene in fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. My guests are Marilyn Pierce-Bolger. She's an advanced nurse practitioner and owner of the Referral and Coordination Agency for the Anchorage Fetal Alcohol Spectrum Disorder Diagnostic Team on the phone from Seattle is Dr. Susan Astley. She is professor of epidemiology and pediatrics with the University of Washington Schools of Medicine and Public Health and director of the Washington State Fetal Alcohol Syndrome Diagnostic and Prevention Network. And also in the studio with Ms. Christy Reinhart. She's a program director with the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education. If you have questions, you can email us during the next 30 minutes or so at line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call us at 550-8433. That's 550-8433. And our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. One more warning. If you're listening between 8 and 9 on a Monday evening, you're listening to a taped rebroadcast. We obviously can't help you there. So let's now talk a little bit more about this idea of how much alcohol we should consider as not being safe to have if we want to try to prevent fetal alcohol syndrome. But before we do that, if you don't mind, Dr. Astley, I'm going to ask you to address this question. But tell us a little bit about what we know about alcohol. And how it works and the timing we've kind of talked about a little bit, but how it causes these problems so we can maybe understand this question about how much is safe or not safe.
Yeah, I think the most important issue when it comes to how much is safe or not safe, you know, and this whole interesting kind of dilemma between science and public health practice. From a scientific standpoint, you know, with all our laboratory highly controlled studies, you know, in maybe animal models, you know, and very sensitive tools to be able to identify, you know, even the subtlest of impact of alcohol exposure. In that kind of a setting, you know, we can identify impacts with all, you know, with very, very low levels of alcohol. But then when you try to translate that into a public health message, well, is a single glass of wine, you know, safe? Well, the real issue is a single glass of wine safe for all fetuses? And I think one of the most illustrative ways of documenting how much we don't know or can't predict about this is we've to date seen about 40, 50 twin pairs in clinic over the 25 years. And as everybody knows, there's twins that are genetically identical and twins that are not identical. But one thing about twins is that they certainly are being identically exposed. But what's fascinating in clinic is when twins are fraternal twins, not genetically identical, but have exactly the same alcohol exposure, it's not uncommon at all for one twin to be born with full-blown FAS and the other to look untouched, normally developed. And I think that's one of the most striking examples. It's not just how much, how often, and when did you drink, but it also has to do with fetal genetics. Some are genetically more susceptible to the alcohol's effects, and some are less susceptible. But the problem is, from fetus to fetus, we don't have the ability to know who's who. We don't have the ability to tell an individual woman the fetus you're carrying is more susceptible or not. So that's why the public health message, the only safe amount is none at all. And again, you know, so it feels like an ultra conservative message, but what we really are trying to do from a public health standpoint is to safeguard all fetuses, not just most of them. And then we get the issue of reality. It's like, okay, well, in a perfect world where all pregnancies are planned and nobody drinks, that seems feasible. But I think the more grounded message, too, is that the only safe amount for all fetuses is none at all. But then, if a woman does discover that she's pregnant, it was unplanned, she had a couple glasses of wine, the most important thing is don't drink any further. You know, so it's never too late to stop drinking during pregnancy. Things can always improve as soon as you quit drinking. So some interesting public health messaging challenges in this field. And maybe Marilyn can pipe in, too, on this.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's because we have different groups that we're trying to help understand the intricacies of this. Some women can't stop, you know, and those women need a different approach than a woman who's choosing to continue to have to engage in social drinking during her pregnancy. And I think the bigger issue, too, related to that latter group is, our larger culture, alcohol is such a huge part of our social systems and our cultural systems. If we're asking women to stop drinking in pregnancy, we're asking them to give up something of their social life. And what are we replacing that with? You know, I think those of us in public health have to think about what can we make for concrete suggestions to women about how they might do things differently to protect their mm-hmm. fetus.
This is just borderlines on this idea. I've always thought as alcohol was very fat soluble. It's one reason we get inebriated so quickly, gets into the brain very quickly. But I didn't realize until looking at some information on this that it's really not cleared from the fetus at anywhere near the rate it is from a human. In fact, the information I read in one source was only about 3-4% of the rate, so much, much, much less likely, suggesting that the environmental milieu of alcohol exposure is over a longer period of time and maybe to a greater percentage in the fetal brain as it's developing.
Yes, that's absolutely right, yeah.
So that's a little bit thought-provoking.
Worrisome. Worrisome would be my word. Yeah.
Okay, where do we want to go? I want to go to, because I want plenty of time to talk about interventions if we can get it. Take us through a diagnosis. Marilyn, you're doing these evaluations. Kind of summarize how an evaluation may happen for an individual.
So we're getting referrals from all over the place. As Dr. Astley mentioned earlier, there's a higher percentage of children who've had alcohol exposure likely to be in the foster care system. Historically, the Anchorage teams had about 41% of our referrals from that source. I will say that if you need a confirmed alcohol history, it's much harder to get from that population for a variety of reasons. And that is a confounding thing when you're trying to do a diagnosis. The diagnostic team is multidisciplinary. We use Dr. Astley's model where we have a medical provider who does a physical exam and facial photo analysis that was developed by the UW team. We have a psychologist or neuropsychologist who does significant amount of testing, several hours worth of testing with the child. Speech pathologist is looking at expressive, receptive social language. And then an occupational therapist who's looking at visual perception, sensory integration, sign of motor and fine motor function. We then sit down together as a group and look at our collective findings for an individual who has come through the team and come up with a consensus diagnosis for them. At that point, the diagnosis does serve as an intervention in that you have a very good roadmap of how that individual's brain may be, quote, built or is functioning, and you know where the strengths are and you know where the challenges are. So for the kids that go through this diagnostic process, and adults as well, they come away from it with a very clear picture of how the world works for them. And then the world needs to respond to them differently. And the world, in the case of a child, is generally a caregiver, parent, and the school system, which needs to respond to them differently depending on their disability.
All right. I have a phone call that I think is going to lead us into some discussion about interventions, but let's check it and see what she says. Alicia, you're on line one.
Hi, thank you. Yeah, my name is Alicia Hildy. I'm actually an Anchorage School Board candidate and a former foster mom. What I want to know is there's any data out there on, you know, educating teens who grow up to be, you know, young adults and on the prevention of FAS and any outcomes that you've seen in targeting that or curriculum component?
All right, so your question is, do we have evidence that early discussions about this problem and its prevention, particularly in, let's say, junior high, high school, is effective? Is that kind of the question?
Yeah, and what they'd like to see if they have any, you know, in their professional opinion.
All right, who wants to handle that question? It's a good one.
This is Christy Reinhart. talking about prevention and healthcare as part of health class discussions and also part of sex education within schools, which is really dependent, of course, on your school district about how in-depth that is going to be. So I think it really depends on where the school is. We know that in other states like Kentucky, for instance, really targeted high school students and giving them information about prenatal exposure to drugs and alcohol. And they did a very interesting thing where, in addition to targeting young women, they also targeted their partners with looking at the social aspect of drinking, particularly among teens, that the message was also for these teenage mothers' partners to help support them in their not drinking. So we know that this is a very important prevention message, but we do not know that this is consistent within Alaska.
The other thing I'll add, this is Marilyn, is if if I'm a clinical provider talking with an adolescent, and Dr. Woodard, you have adolescents in your practice, I think discussing it with them at a young age is important, just to give them a sense about, hey, the way to avoid an alcohol-exposed pregnancy is either to not drink or use effective contraception or not have sex. I mean, I think that there are different strategies depending on that child's family and other sorts of value systems that there may be in their home, et cetera. And I think that giving kids the basic understanding of what it is that this disability is and why it may be a problem for a child, lifelong problem for the child, is important for these kids to understand.
Has there been any data results on, that Kentucky program? Did they come out with any improved outcomes or lower incidence of FAS?
I'm not entirely sure. I know that the state of Kentucky found it very worthwhile for them to continue funding this public health message, particularly because the link between teenage pregnancy and not having contraception and being in a social situation and having some drinks is pretty high.
And teen pregnancy rates are going down in the U.S. We know that there's some things that are shifting. Dr. Astley, I'm wondering if any of what you're seeing in Washington, because you've had some very good programs, are you seeing anything in the education field?
I can't say that I'm familiar with that. So okay. I've been listening with interest to what Christy was sharing with us.
Mm-hmm. All right. Alicia, thanks very much for your call.
Thank you.
Thank you. As a pediatrician again, I'm going to say that I'm constantly trying to get across the message that our brain learns very, very, very well. What it doesn't do is unlearn very well at all, actually. You can't tell me how to stop riding a bike or learn. And it's very hard to change habits. So my knee-jerk answer for education is the earlier, the better. Even in the first couple of years, although I can't envision how that happens with alcohol exposure.
I've actually had young children in my clinical practice who referred to, Mom, do you want to talk to the midwife about any alcohol you might be using? So I think that, the earlier you get the message out is right, that I think we need to be doing that.
Christy, let's talk about interventions.
Well, as they were discussing, one of the important things is being able to have a real understanding about that individual child. And if FASD presents differently in every single child, one of the big things is to understand about that particular individual. And in particular, with the idea of looking at the neurobehavioral impacts of prenatal exposure to alcohol, having early detection, as we know with any disability, is very, very, very important for children. So only about one-third of children within Alaska are currently receiving a standardized developmental screening in their well-child checks. And that's assuming that those are children that are going to be receiving well-child checks. I don't mean to downgrade your profession, but many pediatricians, about a third of them believe that they know what a typically developing two-year-old looks like and so do not use standardized screenings. And one of the problems is some of those early things that we could catch and work on, like delays in language or finer gross motor skills, or how children interact socially with each other, or their abilities to problem solve, which may be indications of the neurological impacts of that prenatal exposure were missing. So then we wait until their school age and they're blowing out because of behaviors, or they're 8 years old and they're not passing a reading assessment, or struggling very hard with elementary math concepts. And if we have a lot of that early screening, that early information in that child's medical records, we'll be able to maybe follow some of those breadcrumbs and look at what might be causing some of those, rather than labeling it that it's just a learning disability or,
attention
worse yet,
problem.
A behavior problem.
Yeah.
So I think that, the importance of early intervention is really crucial because, particularly with FASD, this is very hard to make a determination about what the impact of early intervention would be, because you have to catch them really young. And this is a disability that, unlike any other, that you're looking for it in a child through the maternal health records. And as Marilyn mentioned, a lot of times being able to get that information is very difficult. So I think the first thing, my bandwagon, is we screen them all and you never screen the wrong one.
Mm-hmm. I want Dr. Astley to make a comment about the work that the UW did looking at children who've received diagnoses by age 6. Now, we've also said that the manifestations of this disability may not show up in that under 6 age range, although it might be subtle. And as you're saying, you do a standardized screening, you're more likely to see it. Susan, do you want to talk about that a little?
About the kids under age 6?
Well, about what you saw long term in terms of their outcomes, because my understanding is these kids look much different if they've had early intervention and protected and an understanding of what they need.
Yeah, and to share with everybody, we've been doing these diagnoses now for the better part of 25 years, thousands of individuals later, and so I have quite an opportunity to kind of follow up and how did things go. And if you run an FASD clinic like Marilyn and I are doing, you do have to ask the question, so what? Are we making any difference? As that family, the next family walks out of there with an FASD diagnosis and a brief intervention plan, is life any different for them? Did we make a difference? And so for 25 years, we've always done a survey of all caregivers that have come through clinic, and we send them out with an intervention recommendations, and then we ourselves probably never see them again. We pass them off to their community providers and hope from there they're well held. But the question is, are they? So we have three questions on this survey that I think you'll find interesting. One is we informed them, we sent you out with a list of services and recommendations to try to hook up with. One, could you find them in your community? Now, if we're doing our job, we didn't recommend them if they didn't exist in your community, but we asked them, could you find them in your community? And then, if you could find these interventions, could you access them? Now, that's the million-dollar question. And by access, I mean, did your child have a disability that was significant enough to get them access to that program, insurance purposes, all the reasons that could prevent you from accessing the program? And then finally, if you were able to access the program, did it meet any of your needs? Some of your needs, none of your needs. And in these surveys, we've always coded what the diagnosis was, because what I predicted would happen is that it's the families whose kids walk out with a full-blown diagnosis of FAS. They're going to be the most satisfied. They're going to express the most access to services because their child has this very visible disability, the physical features and all that. And that the families whose kids are at the other end of the spectrum, neurobehavioral disorder, just moderate dysfunction, none of the physical features, that they would have the least satisfaction, that my kid just doesn't have severe enough problems to qualify for services, things like that. I was completely wrong. It turns out that in the surveys, no matter what the diagnosis was on the spectrum, the families expressed unbelievable satisfaction with being able to access services, and if they access them, that they actually, 95% of the families reported that the services met most to all of their needs. And it's like, you're kidding. You know, so, you know, and it was far enough down the road, it wasn't, they're still in the honeymoon period. But I think what it really represented is that, and this is, I think, really important for folks who have diagnostic clinics, is that families have always expressed really enjoying coming to our clinic. They've been to a million other places up before they come to our clinic, typically. But they say that talking with us is, it's like we understand what they're going through. We're not blaming them for poor parenting. We could finish their sentences. We know exactly what they're going through, and, you know, that sort of thing. And that they felt like there was almost like a paradigm shift, that they walked out better understanding the needs of their child, better prepared for how to advocate for them. And nothing in this is talking about a cure. We didn't do anything to cure it. What we did is to provide them access to these services. And these are services that are available to any and all kids with language disabilities or attention deficit or executive function problems. They're not FASD-specific interventions. They are the interventions that are out there already in the community. And when we plugged them into those existing interventions, they had a huge impact on these individuals. I'll share with you one story that just last week I had the unique opportunity of being able to meet one of our patients 20 years later. We diagnosed her with full FAS back when she was 8 years of age. And again, typically, we never hear from them again. Well, she's now almost 30 and came knocking on the door, so to speak. And it's just fascinating to hear how well her life went. And she's married and has a family, and things are really moving forward for her quite well. I'm not saying all outcomes are that good, but it's just really very reassuring to see there's a great deal you can do to improve the lives of these individuals.
Dr. Ashley, the first question that comes to my mind in your study where you looked at these outcomes was, why were individuals with these disabilities not already in services at the time you made the diagnosis, since they were so happy with the results once they made the diagnosis? My second thought is they weren't getting screened, and you made the diagnosis and made the right referral and were otherwise off the, nobody was finding them, either because they weren't in the healthcare system or the healthcare system failed them in making the appropriate referral, let's put it that way.
I think it's a combination of factors. One, I think the most prevalent thing we see, and anybody who knows the education system, and I don't mean this in any negative way, but it takes a pretty strong parental or family advocate to get the services your child needs, mm-hmm. and to understand what services are available to you by law through mm-hmm. the school system. So we spend right. a lot of time educating parents about, did you know that based on these scores, your child actually has access at school to the following intervention services or testing facilities? So there's a great deal of that, of just empowering caregivers to understand that they actually have the law behind them in terms of being of requesting these services. And I think, too, it does help to, again, typically a family's been to every imaginable kind of clinic or individual testing, but nobody's pulled it all together and put it kind of in a context that now feels like it makes sense. You know, maybe they've had speech-language assessments, but that was never tied in with the intellectual functioning the school did or the motor sensory stuff that a pediatrician might have done. And so one of the roles that we play with this interdisciplinary team approach is to pull it all together. And when you pull it all together, it's a much clearer picture for both the families, I think, and the community services as to where to go from here.
I'm going to put a quick plug in that may be, Christy will be happy about. The American Academy of Pediatrics is pushing very hard for patient-centered medical homes. Our office is a patient-centered medical home and does do standardized screening at every visit. And that would allow us to overcome a lot of those problems you just mentioned where people are not pulling things together. And I think most pediatric offices are moving in this direction, although the problem is getting paid for these services. And that means we have a patient-centered, we have patient navigator, patient care coordinator that helps to try to do all this, for which we get nothing in return. So there has to be some changes in the system. I mentioned this also in addition to an email I got where a father of a child with FASD diagnosed here in Anchorage is fighting for what he says is the best for the child at his current facility. He doesn't talk about what that facility is, and he doesn't feel they're able to handle that in spite of the effort. So he's looking basically for more state funding, more funding for facilities. So that all dovetails. Again, things get complex. Money often is where things happen. We only got a couple of minutes. I'm open for any comments back at this.
I just wanted to put in a plug for something that doesn't cost money, and that's one of the things about the FASD community where you see a lot of positive outcomes through informal supports. Oftentimes within the community, you have parents, grandparents, foster parents who form really strong relationships with other parents, and there are FASD camps. I think the longest standing parent support groups I've ever seen have been FASD parent support groups, because that caregiver knowledge, but also that caregiver support is really crucial for creating successful outcomes. So not just tie it to money, but the informal supports for families, because these are significant challenges for a family.
At Christie, this is Marilyn. Christie's spearheading some efforts around the Governor's Council's work towards a 5-year strategic plan in FASD. And I think the very neat thing about that is that you've got some very some good old partners and some new partners putting heads together around what needs to happen, what do we want to see happening in the next 5 years, and who's the best entity to take that on. I'll also put in a quick plug for a new nonprofit we're creating, the Alaska Center for FASD, and the thing that we want to do with that nonprofit is really look for some system change, push for some things that need to be different, and do increase family support and help folks out there in the trenches.
Dr.
And
S.
I'll put in a plug for collect the data at the statewide level. Collect the data. I can't tell you how powerful that data is for change in policy.
Yep. Susan,
I'm living and breathing the impacts of it.
Exactly. We're getting somewhere on that front, Susan. We've been working on that for a while.
We are.
Yeah. Collective impact is collecting the data.
Yeah.
Dr. Ashley, we have about a minute and a half, and what I'm going to do is ask you to just give us a couple of key ideas, key thoughts, key things we want listeners to come away from the program remembering, and if we have a little time, I'll ask our other two guests to chime in their thoughts.
Key things to keep in mind, again, when it comes to drinking during pregnancy, best not to, and if you can't avoid it, try to reduce it as much as possible. When it comes to intervention and diagnosis, the most important thing for the individual exposed to alcohol prenatally is an early and accurate diagnosis. It's never too soon to do that diagnosis, especially if you want to take advantage of the birth to three intervention opportunities. And you know, we at the moment do not have the cure for FAS, but you just can't imagine how much better these individuals are in the long run if they've had the opportunity to have early intervention.
All right. I am going to have to call it a day. Thanks very much to Marilyn Pierce Bolger, Dr. Susan Ashley, and Christy Reinhardt. It's a pleasure to have had the time to talk with you guys.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you.
If listeners want to continue the discussion on fetal alcohol spectrum disorders, you can join KSK on Facebook, and you can find that link at www.alaskapublic.org. You can also find our Line 1 archives at alaskapublic.org. Next week, we're going to be discussing the genetics of cancer, and particularly we'll have a draw attention to the genetics of breast cancer. So why not join us where you can learn more? Monday, October 2nd at 2 p.m., repeating that same evening at 8 p.m. on FM 91.1, Alaska Public Media. Dave Waldron engineered today's program. Eric Bork is our web editor. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day, and don't drink too much out there.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.